The servants of this ideology seek tyranny in the Middle East and beyond. They seek to oppress and persecute women. They seek the death of Jews and Christians and every Muslim who desires peace over theocratic terror.
That was President George W. Bush, of course, last night during a rare White House and primetime news conference where he took questions. This was during his opening remarks. He was talking about, well, he started those remarks by saying none of these acts, and he's talking about the acts of terrorism that he enumerated in great detail, none of these acts is the work of a religion. They are all the work of fanatical political ideology. We're going to be talking with Ergun Kaner here in the first 25 minutes of Issues, etc., about the events in Iraq, in particular in the holy city of Najaf. We'll talk a little bit about what happened a little farther north in Iraq as well, and get his general reaction to the president's view of Islam and whether or not these acts of terrorism really are the acts of a religion or only a political ideology. Can you separate the two when you talk about Islam? Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Also in the news today, you might have seen in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch the headline, "Outsiders Reforms Won't Work, Islamic Nations Say," in reference to a Congress of Democrats from the Islamic world taking place this week in Turkey. Those were some of their ideas. We'll get Ergun Kaner's reaction to that as well. In the second part of this first hour, Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International, joins us for our weekly, well, it's almost a weekly thing now, our religion roundup. We're going to talk about not only a further schism in the church across denominational lines, but also we're going to talk about some words, recent words from the Vatican on why they think there's uprising or insurrection in Iraq. That's with Uwe Simonetto and a few other ideas to discuss with him there in the latter part of this hour. In the second hour of the program, at long last, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery joins us. We're going to get his reaction to the recent ABC TV special, Jesus and Paul. The premise of the program was to pit Jesus and Paul against one another, as though Jesus had a certain theology and a certain teaching, and Paul's differed from that. That Paul somehow embellished or exaggerated or changed the teachings and the meaning of Jesus' life and ministry. Well, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery will be our guest for the entire second hour of Issues, Etc. today to react to that and to generally put down some of the basic premises of liberal theology. In the third hour of the program, we'll spend a little time talking with Arian Campo Flores, author of a story in the latest issue of Newsweek magazine, Get Your Praise On. We'll talk with him for about 10 minutes about Christian nightclubs. That's followed by open lines for your questions and your comments in the entire last third part of the third part of the program today. A couple things I want to talk about. Get your reaction to the president's news conference last night, of course, but also talk to you about a sudden change, a reversal, if you will, in policy. You may have just heard about it at the top of the hour in the Bush administration's plans for Israel. We'll talk about that in the third hour of Issues, Etc. today. Dr. Ergun Kaner is a regular guest. We're always proud to have him alongside to answer questions on Islam. He's professor of theology and church history at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, and author of the books More Than a Prophet and Voices Behind the Veil. Dr. Kaner, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
It's always, always good to be with you, Pastor.
Your reaction to George W. Bush's comments last night that the acts of terrorism that he enumerated, quote, are not the work of a religion, but are the work of a fanatical political ideology?
I've been speaking about this all day. This is certainly, for Christians, we're listening more to the news than we ever have. Let me do something that I haven't done yet, which is, let me preface my remarks by saying, I thank God for what our president has done, and that is, you know, Islam is listening when he speaks. Islam is listening to resolve. And these acts of bombings, these suicide bombers, are hoping to get us off course. And so, if they can do so, then they feel they have won. I mean, they cannot win on a straight up and down war. They have to try to do it like, from behind the scenes. So with that said, I'm glad that his resolve was intractable. You understand that we say we will stay until the job is done. We have to be strong. We have to be steadfast. When it comes to the theological issues, you know, we have to remember that the president is commander-in-chief. He is not theologian-in-chief. I know on a cursory level his exposure to world religions and apologetics, but from a Christian standpoint, what he said is it's untenable. It's impossible. You cannot. This is a fundamental understanding for Islam. Islam has never, in 1,300 years, has never distinguished between politic and life, between theology and ethic. Islam is not a religion. It is a way of life. It's a theocracy. What they do politically is based on, always, always, always based on how they believe the Quran teaches. You can't separate it. If you separate it, you are trying to treat Islam as if they are a democracy. And, of course, Islam does not exist as a democracy. I think when his advisors, I don't think that the president is off here. I think his advisors are. When his advisors commit the ignorant sin of trying to distinguish between politic and belief, they are neglecting the very essence of why, goodness gracious, why is it that there is no shortage of suicide bombers? Why is it that the people who are making the calls are not generals? They are imam. You know, they are the pastors of the mosques. Why is it that fatwas are not signed by lieutenants? Fatwas are signed by the ulema, the scholars in the Islamic teaching. Because there is no distinction between that which they do as a country, that which they do as a people, and that which they believe as Muslims.
And you base this reaction on, as a former Muslim yourself, don't you, Dr. Kim?
Of course, yes. I mean, I was raised with this. We have never, what was hard for me, I'm thrilled with it now, but democracy was difficult for me. Remember, when a Muslim looks at America and they point to Janet Jackson in the Super Bowl, they point to that and say, see, that's the Christians. You understand? They do not believe, not a single Muslim on the planet believes they're at war with America, the geopolitical superpower. They're at war with what they perceive, even though you and I would disagree, but what they perceive is America, the Christian nation. If you forget this point, if they neglect this point, they have missed the most profound distinction between Islam and any other world religion. Islam is an ethic. It is a way of life. It is not just a system of beliefs that we follow on Friday in the mosque. It is literally prescriptive every minute of every day.
It occurs to me at this point, and correct me if I'm wrong, that not only did the president portray a lack of understanding of Islam as a religion that does not distinguish between religion and political ideology, they are one and the same.
Absolutely.
But when the Muslim looks at the United States and Western powers, they also fail to recognize that we do make a distinction between religious beliefs, that we can wage war for non-religious purposes, for secular purposes.
Well, we have Christians in the army, you know, and I'm thankful for this, but we do not have a Christian army. The distinction is the secular powers are in charge of our military, not the church. The pastors go along as chaplains. They do not hold any kind of, you know, their rank is never as commander. Their rank is that as support and always will be. And that is one of the fundamental points that Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Hamilton, Aaron Burr, the framers of American origin, they had to make that line. They had to draw the distinction between it. To make that line, they had to literally push the pastors into the churches, so to speak.
Does the Muslim look at the occupying troops in Iraq, for instance, with chaplains, Christian chaplains, and of course all other kinds of chaplains is there, but do they say this is a Christian army occupying our nation?
Well, no, not in general. They know that this. I think if there's anything that has come from this war, they have seen that this is not. They were, you know, I'm sure you read the transcripts. They were looking, you know, shoot for the priests, and there were no priests. You know, they were coming up against the generals, and I think they're starting to slowly discover this. But remember, Bin Laden, whenever the transcript is released, and it's Bin Laden or Fazlur Rahman or Mullah Omar, what do they call us? They call us the Crusaders. Now, this is not because they think it's a cute catchphrase. 1,000 years ago, there was a Christian army. You know, we committed the atrocity of Christian jihad. We did the same thing. And so they still see it as the same. They still see us as an army led of Christians. You know, you brought up something that I wanted to come back to in your introduction. The network broadcast of Jesus and Paul. Remember, they try to make the line of distinction between Jesus' teachings and what they believe to be Paul's changing of Christianity. When that was shown, I took a clip of it and showed it to every one of my classes. That is precisely what Islam teaches. Islam teaches that Jesus in his purest form taught something that was radically different. It was corrupted by Paul. And so the Christianity to which they respond today, they believe, is an abrogation. It's a change by Paul. So that was Islamic doctrine on Jesus.
So that's why they can claim Jesus is a prophet, mm-hmm. and yet at the same time denounce Christian doctrine.
Oh, absolutely. They say any Christian doctrine was developed by Paul. Peter Jennings and his boys basically made a good case for every Islamic mosque. When they basically presented Islamic gospel according to the Quran, because in the Quran, Paul is the corrupter of what they believe to be the pure teachings of Jesus. When Jesus was born, they have him speaking in the cradle, and his first words are, "I am a prophet, I am not God." And, you know, they believe that Paul changed that. That's what Peter Jennings taught. I find it fascinating. They abhor anything that the Passion stood for, but they apparently seem to love Islamic doctrine.
Dr. Kaner, let's talk about Najaf, holy city, holy site. Why is it revered among Muslims worldwide?
There, you have to make a distinction here. Remember, Islam is not monolithic. There are fights between Sunni and Shiite. There are fights between Shia, Sunni, and Sufi. You have in Najaf a holy site to certain sects. The Shia hold it as holy. You have the split after Muhammad dies. And after Muhammad dies, you have two men who become the de facto leaders of Islam, Abu Bakr and Ali. Ali is the one that the Shia believe should have been the leader. Abu Bakr is the one that the Sunni, the vast majority of Muslims worldwide, believe should have been the leader. Najaf becomes the place of conflict. It is a war zone at one point. It is also considered the holy city of revelation in Islam. There is no coincidence why the bombings have increased in the past month. None. This is not by accident. They believe that we bomb their holy sites on their holy days, i.e. Ramadan. I mean, my imam used to warn us before Ramadan, prepare for war worldwide. You know, prepare for attacks worldwide. So why are they bombing now? It's Easter. It's both the what we would know as Eastern, and, of course, the Orthodox Easter is coming up. And so you have, you know, a theology that drives even their militaristic actions.
Now, it's revered because it is supposedly the burial site of the what the Shiites believe to be the rightful heir to Muhammad.
And remember, exactly, and remember, it is also the site where he was told he was to be the leader. Remember, let's just use a comparison here. I happen to be a Baptist. I was saved Black Baptist and National Baptist. I am now Southern Baptist. Presbyterians and I worship differently, but I believe Presbyterians going to heaven. They believe in Jesus Christ, and so do I. In Islam, it is different. In Islam, Sunni declare that Shia are gulat, cult. In every mosque I lived in until I came to America, a mosque was defined by whether it was Shia or Sunni or Sufi. Sufi are the third, it's a minor sect. And so they do not believe that, Sunni do not believe that Shia are going to be in paradise, and Shia do not believe that Sunni are going to be in paradise, at least the theologians don't. And so when you talk about Najaf, you are talking about a holy site for Shia, but not necessarily so holy for the Sunni.
So why are we hearing in the press, true or otherwise, that we are watching the Sunni and the Shia in Iraq take up common cause together mm-hmm. against the occupying forces?
Well, this is also something that is part of our history, but it is true. One of the names that they have given Osama bin Mohammed bin Laden is the Muslims call him, when they are shouting in the streets, they call him Saladin. Let me give a bit of history. This is something that we deal with, by the way, in the book More Than a Prophet. Saladin discovered the one secret to get Muslims to stop fighting each other. I mean, we now have 1,300 years of Islamic history. In 1,300 years of Islamic history, Muslims have been fighting for almost 200 of them. For all but 200 of them. So for 1,100 years, we have been fighting. My people have been fighting. Almost always we have either fought against each other or against a common enemy. Saladin found that secret. Saladin decided, make them fight against a common enemy, a common Iblis, if you would. That's the Shaitan, Satan. That's what Bin Laden has done. Bin Laden has, for the first time in a millennia, united all Muslims in a common cause. Remember Iran and Iraq? They fought in the 80s against each other. Pakistan, you have internal civil wars constantly. Sunni fighting Shia, Wahhabi joining in, Alawites, you know, everybody's fighting everybody else. Until along comes bin Laden, February 23rd, 1998, signs a fatwa that unites Sunni and Shia against a common enemy.
What about the teachings of the Quran, and in particular, Muqtada al-Sadr, the cleric there in Najaf, who has got his own army against the coalition forces, taking refuge at or near the shrine of Imam Ali?
Exactly.
Is this something that he is expected to do? Is it considered to be an act of cowardice? How was it perceived?
Absolutely considered an act of cowardice. Absolutely, without question. But remember, we follow a just war criteria. The development of the early church, when Christians started fighting in the army, 185, Marcus Aurelius had the Thundering Herd, which was a Christian group in his military. When Christians started fighting in the military, we had to find some biblical parameters by which we operated, right? And so when we operate by these parameters, we have certain things that we do and do not do. We do not engage civilians. Civilians are those who have not taken up arms. They have not taken up arms. They are the innocent victims, and thus, you know, we wouldn't have our army hiding in a daycare center. But in Islam, again, going back to our opening discussion, Pastor, our opening discussion that there is no such thing as a separation between theology and ethic in Islam. There is no such thing as a political group and not a theological group. Everyone is a Muslim, you know, at least in theory, and thus there is no such thing as civilian. Hiding in a daycare center, hiding in a holy shrine, hiding in a place that is considered holy, hiding in a mosque, knowing that if we bombed a mosque, you know, Muslims worldwide would be infuriated. They operate this way because they know we are hamstrung. We are tied to our commitment not to engage the civilian. They will literally do it. They will literally do it. They will hide themselves. Look at what took place a year ago, when they came and went into the church in Nazareth, and then into the church in Bethlehem. Why did they go into the church in Bethlehem? Well, because there is no such thing as a holy site that is off limits.
Now, let's talk a bit about the pronouncement of a Congress of Democratic Islamic of Democrats of the Islamic World that took place this week in Turkey. The headline reads, "Outsiders reforms won't work," although if you read the body of the story, they're saying, well, you know, democracy might have a future in the Islamic world. It's just not going to be imposed by the Western world. Does democracy have a future among Islamic nations?
All right. Well, first, this meeting that they had, and I would love to get that link from you, because I constantly deal with these people. We were on C-SPAN again just about 3 weeks ago dealing with this. There are two groups that exist that call themselves either the Circle of Muslim Democrats or the Coordination of Muslim Democrats. Both are headed by Abdelhamid Dahmein, and he is in France. You have to remember this fundamental thing when they call themselves the Circle of Muslim Democrats. They believe their purpose is to give Islam a voice in democratic societies. They are not advocating that Islamic nations become democratic. In other words, for instance, the Circle of Muslim Democrats are headquartered in France. There are now 5.3 million Muslims in France who are either practicing or non-practicing. There's some disagreement on this issue, but in France, they are really getting loud in the political process because they want Muslims to have a voice, an organized lobby group, if you would, in Paris, France. Well, if you were to turn and ask them, great, can Christians have a voice in Syria? Can Christians have a voice in Lebanon, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Iran, Iraq? Well, of course you can't. We are an Islamic republic. But because they exist in a democratic society, they use the title Circle of Muslim Democrats. They're meeting in Turkey this week. This is not for the purpose of for Islam to embrace democracy. It's for Islam. Excuse me. It's for Islam to have a voice in our democracies. Whenever they begin these discussions, I say I think it's wonderful. I think you should have a voice. But all I ask is that you let me as a Christian have a voice in your country. but of course they can't. In other words, they're willing to use democracy for their ends, but they're not willing to let it be equitable.
Is democracy compatible with Islam?
Absolutely not. Absolutely. And Pastor, you've hit right on the central issue. Anything in Islam, one of the central tenets of what we are hoping takes place in Iraq, what we are hoping takes place in Afghanistan, is that the Muslim republics, they call themselves Islamic republics, is that they embrace two things, freedom of speech and freedom of religion, freedom of dissent, if you would. And that includes dissent against Islam, dissent against philosophy, dissent against anything. But you see, Islam has never, in 1,300 years, it has never allowed for dissent. Islam does not have religious freedom. It has religious toleration. You know, religious toleration is based on one of the first caliphs named Umar. He had a thing called the Pact of Umar, which allowed for Christians to live in an Islamic state under certain conditions. Number one, that they give up their seat to a Muslim who comes into the room, that they allow their children to marry Muslims and become Muslim. But at no time do they ever allow a Muslim to become a Christian. And thus, it is religious toleration, but it is not in any way religious freedom. Democracy gives a voice to the heretic. A great book from Christian history is a book written by Balthasar Hubmaier. And Hubmaier wrote a book called On Heretics and Those Who Burn Them. The basic idea is this. In a democracy, you have to let the heathen worship. You have to let the heathen be a heathen. You can't. Coerced faith is not faith. Coerced belief is not true belief. But in Islam, they cannot and will not allow for it.
Dr. Kaner, thank you very much for being our guest. Before you go, tell us about your forthcoming book on the Crusades. I'm very interested.
Well, we're going to take a lot of heat from it. Of course, you know I teach with Dr. Falwell here and many strong Christian militaristic people. But we have turned the attention of jihad now to Christian history. And there was a period of time where Christians, whether we like it or not, we embraced jihad. It was called the Crusades, the Inquisitions. Anytime we kill in the name of Christ and try to coerce faith, we are not doing what Christ called us to do. It's certainly controversial. It's caused me more trouble than I thought I would ever face, but I think it was worth writing. I'm glad it's called Christian Jihad, and it comes out in just about a month. Looks like it's going to be reviewed in the New York Times and some others, because it's interesting that a Christian would write this.
I'd like to have you on when the book comes out. I have an opportunity to read it. I'd be love to have you back as a guest, Dr. Kaner. Thank you for being our guest in this half hour.
Again, thank you, Pastor.
Dr. Aragon Kaner, Professor of Theology and Church History at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. He's author of the books More Than a Prophet and Voices Behind the Veil, his forthcoming book, Christian Jihad. When we come back from this break, Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International, joins us from Washington, D.C. We're going to be getting our religion roundup. We'll start out with a piece that he wrote called Revolt Due to Inferiority Complex. Apparently, one of the Vatican's leading experts on Islam told United Press International early this week that the Shiite revolt in Iraq must be seen as a part of basically a Muslim inferiority complex. We'll find out what that's all about when we come back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, etc.
Many today equate the worship of God with feeling good about God or about themselves. What is the genuine worship of God through which God heals our anxiety, our depression, and our guilt? Where can we find worship that's focused on God's forgiveness rather than our feelings? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April is called They Will See His Face, Worship and Healing. It's by Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. Richard Iyer. You can order They Will See His Face by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The book is called They Will See His Face. When you call or write, mention Issues, etc. 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on a country where radio can speed news about Christ. It's in the East African country of Sudan. Educational Media Corporation, through its Global Endeavor Ministry, has recently placed 3 radio stations on air inside Sudan. The radio signals blanket the entire country with Christian programming. This is vital since hundreds of thousands of Christians have died in Sudan from persecution during the past decade. Global Endeavor has established Radios for Sudan. It's a project to put 10,000 solar and hand-crank radio sets into families and villages. Pray that the support and distribution of these radio sets will fill people in Sudan with Christ's hope. Get more news about Radios for Sudan by calling Global Endeavor at 1-877-255-8667. That's 1-877-255-8667.
Christ's first miracle. Was it at a wedding?
Answers with Ken Ham, one of North America's best-known Bible conference speakers. Well, Ken, I've always been told that Jesus' first miracle was when he turned the water into wine at the wedding feast at Cana. But do I understand here that this isn't so?
Well, you know, almost everyone thinks that this was the first miracle performed by Jesus, but that's not really the case. I posed this riddle to our staff recently, and some of them came up with the answer. Well, first, John 1 verses 1 to 3 state, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made." Also, Colossians 1:16 states, "For by him were all things created that are in heaven and that are in earth, visible and invisible." So if the Bible clearly teaches that Jesus was the creator of everything, then the first miracle he performed isn't found in John chapter 2. It's really in Genesis 1:1, where we read, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth." You see, God the Son, Jesus Christ, was the creator, and his perfect creation was the very first miracle.
Find out more about Christ's first miracles in the book of Genesis when you read Ken Ham's fascinating booklet, The 6 Days of Creation. It's free when you log on to AnswersRadio.com. You'll be tremendously built up in your faith when you go to AnswersRadio.com. That's AnswersRadio.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. There is nothing inherently wrong with leaven.
Hey. You've heard the saying, it's a jungle out there. That's true. But if you're like most of today's families, it's a jungle right here, right now. Find direction with Dr. James Dobson and focus on the family. Straight answers and solid advice for dealing with life in the jungle.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Uwe Simonetto is our guest for the remainder of this hour. He joins us on a regular basis to do a religion roundup. Today we've got a couple items to deal with. I also would like his initial reaction to the subject that will be first up as we discuss the Shiite revolt. Insurrection, they say uprising. That's a hard one to sell. In fact, last night when the president had his press conference, he made a point. Did you notice? He made a point of saying, "This is not a popular insurrection," when he was talking about what's going on in Najaf and in Ramadi and in Fallujah. This is not a popular insurrection. I wonder what he meant by that. Well, we'll be talking with Uwe Simonetto here for the next 25 minutes. Then in the second hour of the program, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery joins us. We're going to be talking to him about the special that you saw last week on Monday, ABC TV, Jesus and Paul. How is it that the case is made, or can a case be made, that Jesus and Paul have two different theologies, that Jesus' simple rabbi teaching tolerance and love was twisted and perverted by Paul, who started a religion called Christianity? That was the premise of the Peter Jennings special, with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's response and his argument against that position. In the second hour of the program, in the third hour, we'll talk about Christian nightclubs with Arian Campo Flores, and then we have open lines for the remainder of that hour. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe Simonetto is a regular guest. He's religion editor for United Press International. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Uwe, welcome back.
Hello. How are you?
doing well. Your reaction to all that has happened in the last week, especially over the Easter weekend in Iraq?
Well, my reaction is this. First of all, you have to separate things here. You just mentioned in the intro the term insurrection, which is absolutely against the Quran. So if this were an insurrection, it would be anti-Quranic. You have on one side, of course, the hangers-on of Saddam Hussein, plus, of course, the radicals who are infiltrating the country. On the other side, you have one minority of the Shia. Shias are the majority in Iraq, but a minority seems to be rebelling, even though their leader, Sadr, is now, of course, in hiding and wants to negotiate with the Americans, and he seems to be quite scared. I don't really see this as an intervention. I think I see this as a result of a very disordered society, and you know we can theologize about this a great deal because a disordered society always leads into chaos, and there is a very interesting point. Luther has made a very interesting point. That the rabble has no reason, and so therefore, if you have an insurrection, in other words, if you prepare for a change of regime and a tyranny, you must make sure that you can establish order beforehand. But before you do this, you must establish order. Otherwise, the result will be chaos, and chaos is doing the devil's work.
Uwe, you spoke recently to one of the Vatican's leading experts on Islam, Reverend Hans Viking. He's an instructor for the Pontifical Institute on Arab and Islamic Studies.
Right.
He says, according to what you've written most recently, that the Shiite revolt in Iraq is largely due to what he called a Muslim inferiority complex. What does he mean by that?
Well, not just the Shiite thing, but the other thing as well. The inferiority complex is this, that since Napoleon landed in Egypt in 1798 with the French army, so suddenly the Muslims, who had been living in a sort of slumber, in a sense, for by then about 800 years, suddenly recognized that they their inferiority, technological inferiority, their societal inferiority, you know, they were way behind. And that seems to, according to Föcking, who speaks perfect Arabic and has been teaching in Arab countries and all sorts of things, that it seems to be an innate, almost innate sort of complex. Why is it that we cannot free ourselves, we Muslims cannot free ourselves from tyranny? Why is it that others have to come in? This response was, in fact, to my question. Do you have a feeling that these guys have lost their sense of reason, of their natural reason? And he said, well, you know, there are atavistic feelings here that surpass or supersede reasoning.
I'm wondering about that history and whether or not the sense of inferiority has been compounded of late, but first, before we get to that, do the Iraqi people, the Muslims there, do they consider what has taken place in the last year and a half a liberation?
Well, according to the latest polls that I've seen, I haven't been there for a number of years, but since the latest polls that I've seen, yes, 57% consider this a liberation, are pleased with it all, so there's a majority that feels being liberated. The question is, there is, as we speak, other than the United States, there is no power in place that they can support. I mean, that's the whole problem.
Well, how do they feel about this liberation coming at the hands of Western powers, in particular the United States and European powers?
Well, again, I'm just quoting. I'm just quoting polls here, and according to this survey, a significant majority of the Iraqis are pleased with having been liberated by the West. They are, but then you must also understand that the majority of the Iraqis are not radical Muslims. In fact, I mean, they're sort of rather lax Muslims, and most Europeans have been lax Christians for a long time. What we're dealing with here, the insurrection, is simply, you know, you have bullies in the cloth of clerics, or bullies posing as clerics, or bullies who are actually Marxist-Leninists of the old Ba'ath Party, which ruled this country for more than three decades.
Describe, if you will, what you learned about the differences. I'm thinking about the mutilations, the killings and the mutilations that took place
right in
Fallujah that made the news a couple weeks back. The differences between Sunni and Shiite beliefs on what took place there.
Well, as I said, according to Sunni belief, absolutely, if it's orthodox, absolutely rejects any form of insurrection and says it's the devil's work. That is pretty much, in a sense, also a Christian belief. Certainly a Lutheran belief insurrection is wrong. The Shiite have a tradition, I mean, the very word assassin is of Shiite Arab origin. The assassins were 12th, 13th century Shiite rebels who rebelled against another dynasty ruling that part of the world. And actually, the word Shia assassin comes from hashish smokers, and then used hashish to get themselves geared up to see paradise before while readying themselves for martyrdom. That is there is the difference here. So therefore, what you see in Fallujah is, in Muslim terms, in Sunni Muslim terms, because these guys are Muslims, Sunni Muslims, is against the Quran, whereas there are Shiites who believe that you can rebel. But clearly the majority of the Shiites, including their top leader, are against this.
You have written recently, you have been writing recently, about what you call a schism running horizontally through most Christian denominations.
Right.
Your latest installment has to do with opposing views of original sin or opposing answers to the question, why did Jesus die on the cross? Describe that for us, if you would, Uwe.
Well, the orthodox view, why did Jesus cry on the cross, which is also described, of course, very clearly in Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ, is he died for our sins. God made himself small, went to the cross, and died for our sins, took this upon himself. The other view is, of course, that this is all nonsense. I suppose the most extreme view is we don't need bleeding men dangling from the cross, which is what the reimagining feminists do when they meet in the sordid parts of this country, meaning feminist pastors, women pastors. And, of course, the other view is that that sin is really non-existent. What we have to do here is a disorder that can be treated therapeutically. And of course, there's nothing ontological about sin. There's nothing inherent. There's nothing original about sin. Sin is simply a way of behaving badly, and you should therefore just change your attitude to Scripture. So therefore, they don't buy into the Christian story that of the fall.
In fact, I was reading just this morning an interview with Nobel laureate Desmond Tutu, retired Archbishop of Cape Town in South Africa, an admirable man in many respects, but he has written a new book called God Has a Dream.
Yeah.
In the interview, he says, because love is universal, you don't have to believe in God to know that loving is better than hating. We are trying to remind them, that is the readers, I suppose, that all of us are fundamentally good. The aberration is the bad person. Does he represent that latter view of sin?
Yeah. Well, evidently, I don't know. I mean, well, yes, he does. I mean, he is very much, it's very strange for an African, because most Africans, as you know, most African church leaders, who are very good theologians, by the way, whether they are Lutheran or Anglican or Catholic, they're extremely learned theologians, take a very orthodox view, the first view of sin that I described before, whereas Tutu and his entire church down there is utterly westernized, and which is very, very strange indeed. It is also does also not square with interestingly the tribal African view of sin, which again resembles very much the Christian view in that it is a turning away from God, is a willful disobedience to God.
So is this why, in contrast to former Bishop Tutu's views, what we're finding in the flourishing of Christianity in Africa is generally a flourishing of Orthodox Christianity?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It is. I mean, that is this what I'm calling in my series the horizontal schism within the church is, of course, running horizontally across our various denominations here in the Northern Hemisphere, plus, of course, across a north-south divide within the same families of denominations, say Lutherans or Anglicans or Roman Catholics.
Which view, if this divide exists, which view seems to have the upper hand at this point?
Well, absolutely the Orthodox view. I mean, you can see, for example, the Episcopal Church in this country has shrunk to about 800,000 churchgoers on a given Sunday. And of those, even the majority are not the, the liberals, if you want to call them that, but are the Orthodox ones, whereas the Anglican churches in the Southern Hemisphere, Africa, Asia, South America, are burgeoning. I mean, they're growing by leaps and bounds. The more they persecute them, the more they grow. The same thing is true for the Lutheran church. You go to the places like Tanzania, for example, and you have an explosive growth of Orthodox Lutheran beliefs and Lutheran churches, and in the north, especially in Europe, of course, they're shrinking.
You mention also in the same piece, you make reference to the ABC television special Jesus and Paul and Jennings' treatment of what he believes to be a divide between the teachings of Jesus and the teachings of Paul. What do you make of that?
Well, to me it is absolutely baffling. If you were to say, were to do a piece on George Washington and were to say that he had a wife called Martha, and he was a slaveholder, and then he had farms and God knows what else, and he lived in Virginia, and did a three-hour program on that without mentioning that he's the father of this nation and the first president of the United States, you'd call the producer and say, would you please enter my straitjacket here quickly, and I fold your arms behind you and send you off to the booby hatch. I mean, this is where they belong. I mean, Peter Jennings not once mentions that Paul is obviously the chosen first theologian of the church, and Paul explains what the incarnation and crucifixion of Christ is all about, namely salvation. And none of that is even mentioned. I mean, in a three-hour program, that is really astounding. I mean, this takes some doing, I must say.
The liberal theologians and scholars 20 years ago were trying to chip away at what they called the historical Jesus, or reinvent the historical Jesus.
Yeah.
They seem to have moved on to Paul for some reason. You have any insight why that might be?
Well, they move on to, I don't know why that might be. I mean, they move on to Paul because Paul had so many things to say, you know, which they can figure on. He was, quote, was he a homophobe, you know, and was he an anti-feminist, or was he pro-feminist, and was he anti-Jewish, and there are all sorts of things. And then this is, they moved on to this thing, and now they're trying to treat Paul in a funny sort of way, and then actually came to the extraordinary conclusion, which is quite correct, that he was definitely not anti-women, or that he was not anti-Jewish. But they focus on that because they can't make heads or tails of Jesus, But then, of course, they stop at Paul at Romans 3 and sort of jump over Romans 3 altogether. Of course, you wouldn't even think that they would come anywhere near Romans 13, but that's another issue.
Uwe, finally, tell us about this national study of college students from the Higher Education Research Institute at the University of California, Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's quite interesting, isn't it? They found that the majority of the future teachers, education student majors, and etc., that they are actually quite people of faith, whereas my tribe, the journalists, for example, or the natural scientists are not. What is interesting in this study, and doctors, by the way, pre-med students who would ultimately become doctors or nurses or that sort of thing, dentists. There is an interesting thing here which has to be explored further, because most theologians engaged in the dialogue with science will tell you that that the physicists are leading the scientists returning to, let's say, an openness towards the creation idea, be it intelligent design or theistic evolutionism or that sort of thing, because they stand in awe of what they see out there, Big Bang, whereas, curiously, the biologists are the most rabid atheists at the moment. And the explanation here given by people involved in this dialogue, which is global and growing, would say that, the biologists are too involved with the nitty-gritty. They can't get the big picture. And so, therefore, they see, for everything there's an answer, and, you have figures here, and so there is no God. What intrigues me here is the same thing that's always intrigued me about my fellow journalists, and that is this. How can you actually stand in front of all these discoveries, DNA and what have you, or as a journalist, how can you look at the world without asking questions? And why would you just always find answers without actually first asking questions, or just stopping short of asking questions? And that seems to be an issue here, which I think in the long run will be overcome, because the same way it seems to be overcome in physics. It is simply that while they are coping with all these discoveries in biology and in other fields, they do not get the larger picture. The same is true, by the way, also in medicine. You see, they are too busy to consider God, because they're too busy having to learn all the nitty-gritty in medicine.
Uwe, we didn't schedule a talk about this, but I have to get a journalist's perspective on what I saw and heard last night.
Yeah.
Did you have the opportunity to watch the press conference that the president gave last night?
Yes, in part. Mm-hmm.
What is your general impression of the White House press corps during that event last night?
Well, I think the White House press corps, look, I used to be a White House correspondent myself once, and the White House press corps hasn't differed very much. They have asked the questions. They had time to ask the questions. They asked the questions well. They were considered, these questions, and they were legitimate. And I think the president handled himself very well. What I found less appealing was this morning's discussion over how well we responded or not. I mean, journalists are not here to be the eternal judges of everybody else but themselves. And that seems to have been the problem. But I found them okay. I found them professional.
Was there any question, had you had opportunity to stand there in the East Room of the White House last night with the president, any question that you would have been asking?
Yeah, well, the one question I would obviously ask, and I mentioned it a little earlier, I hinted on that, is how can you go into the situation without considering the repercussions locally, or without actually pr- pressing your collaborators, your cabinet secretaries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, into coming out, playing out a scenario of how this would happen. I mean, that they should have been surprised by this uprising, or by the chaos, really. It's not really an uprising, but the chaos that prevails there, starting months ago with the ransacking of the Baghdad Museum. That surprised me. I mean, that there was not more given. Why did they not have, for example, sociologists of religion giving them a detailed analysis of what went on in the minds of these people? That is the one thing that I think was missing there.
Do you think that there is or has been a fundamental misunderstanding, or perhaps just a blind spot in the administration's policy when it comes to understanding Islam and the Islamic world?
I don't think it's just this administration. I think it's generally the West and the United States in particular, not just Islam. Look, what Max Weber has taught us a century ago almost, that internalized religious doctrine determines the behavior of communities and individuals should be standard knowledge. But when I teach journalism students, they've never heard of Max Weber, and they certainly haven't heard of that doctrine. And when I'm here with people from the White House or from the occasionally from the Pentagon or Defense Department, they haven't heard of it either. It is simply something, if you will, they are the victims of the same delusion that that has plagued us now for the last 100 years, that religion is somehow immaterial to world affairs. And I think and Bush, to his credit, is probably the first one to recognize that it is a matter of concern, but of course they didn't go far enough. I mean, they thought they would all behave like Christians in Paris and dance in the streets when the Visayas arrived, you know.
Uwe C. Minetto, thank you very much for your time and for your insight into those final questions. Thank you for being our guest.
Thanks very much, Al.
Uwe C. Minetto, religion editor for United Press International. He joined us from Washington, D.C., talking about various subjects there and getting a few of his thoughts on last night's press conference. That's something I want to pick up during open lines in the last hour of the program. Now, your general reaction to the president's, and it's a rare occurrence with President George W. Bush, primetime press conference, and for him, a rather long one. It went, I think, a little bit over an hour, and he took a lot of questions. A lot of the questions were repetitive, but he seemed to pretty much stick to the game plan. Your reaction to that in the third hour of Issues, etc. When we come back, we'll get Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's response to the ABC TV special Jesus and Paul. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, etc. Issues, etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.